Superbrain is a labour of love. Alas, no podcast can survive on love alone. We don't have a sponsor, so we need your support for Superbrain to stay alive and kicking. You can make a one-off donation by following the Support This Show link in the show or episode description.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
My name is Sabina Brennan, and you are listening to Superbrain, the podcast for everyone with a brain. What if stress, anxiety, depression, autism, neurodiversity, drug dependence, brain fog, and IBS got in common? Well, they are all influenced by your gut, more specifically the bacteria in your gut, which in turn is influenced by the food that you eat. My guest today, Professor John Cryan, has spent decades researching the neurobiological basis of stress-related neuropsychiatric disorders, including depression, anxiety, and drug dependence, with a key focus on understanding the interaction between brain, gut, and the microbiome, and how it applies to stress and immune-related disorders. Thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on Superbrain. And boy, you have a superbrain after that list of achievements and accolades and all the things that you've done. You are a classic example of somebody who really maximizes their brain function. I'm fascinated by your work. I don't often have a scientist on the show because I like to kind of just chat with people from, you know, a broad variety of life and spheres about surviving and thriving in life. But your work really caught my attention as someone who's fascinated by the human brain, because you extend it, you know, to the gut, and you're fascinated by the gut, the brain, the microbiome, and how it actually impacts on our behavior, on our mental health, on our well-being and beyond. So, I mean, first of all, I really kind of first came across the microbiome when I read your book. So perhaps you might kind of just start by explaining what it is.
Sure. And thank you, Sabina, for having me on. The microbiome is basically a catch-all phrase for the trillions of microbes. Predominantly, we focus on bacteria that we have in our gut. And like over the last two decades or so, people have began to really understand that these bacteria can actually play a big role in helping our immune system develop, and that playing a role in shaping various organs and systems within the body, and then also including the brain. And so that was kind of how I'm a stress neurobiologist, and so I still see myself as interested in how stress is affecting the brain, but also how stress affects the body. And I'm mainly talking about chronic stress or traumatic type stressors. And we showed many years ago that when in animals, that when they were stressed early in life, that one of the things that happened to them was that it changed the composition of these microbes in their gut. And that was kind of, okay, that was interesting. It could be an epiphenomenon, it could be other things, but we were interested.
So what's an epiphenomenon?
So it could be just due an artifact. It could be due to something else happening. Could, you know, it may not, you know, like there could be other things that are at play. And then we found a study that had been published, not in a big glamorous journal, but in a society journal some years before, which showed that mice that grow up without microbes in their gut, that they have an elevated stress response.
Oh,
okay. So that was telling us that stress was being regulated by the microbes, and our newer data was then showing that microbes respond to stress. And then the next part of the puzzle was, could we target these microbes or by giving, again, and starting off in animal models, could we give a specific strain of bacteria and show that it affected the stress response? And indeed it could. And so that kind of was the journey. That was kind of the starting point for me in getting excited about these microbes. And then what we did was we looked at the brains of these animals that grow up without microbes, and they are completely messed up. And so basically it meant that for brain development, you need appropriate microbes in your gut. So now we always had going back to Hippocrates, we always knew that the gut was involved in brain processes. But now we have a kind of a new mechanism for understanding these gut feelings and gut instincts, that they may actually be driven by what's actually going on in the gut. And the next part of the puzzle for us then was how could microbes in the gut signal to the brain? And we did some studies, again, starting off in animal studies, where we were very interested in what's known as the vagus nerve. Now, vagus comes from the same origins in language as vagrant and vagabond. It means wandering. So this is a long wandering nerve that sends signals from our organs to our brain and from our brain to our organs. It's the nerve that gets recruited when any of your listeners do mindfulness. It's recruiting the vagus nerve to help us feel how we feel. And so we showed in our animal studies, when we cut the vagus nerve, all of the effects of a specific bacteria were gone. And so this is, as I like to remind people, that what happens in Vegas doesn't just stay in Vegas, but actually affects our emotions. But this was one of the key pathways. And that got us really excited well over a decade ago now into really thinking that we're really onto something and trying to understand gut-brain communications in a new way. And that's why we wrote the book, which was what was called The Psychobiotic Revolution. My colleague Ted Dynan, who was chair of psychiatry here in Cork, and myself wanted to really get it out there that there's really something in this. And this is really important to how we do things.
And I'm so glad you did get it out there, because it is super important. Because, you know, as you said, you really are a stress neurobiologist, and stress is related to, you know, almost all of our, acquired illnesses, for want of a better word, our lifestyle related illnesses. Yeah. And for any sort of, any chronic illness, stress plays a role. You know, brain fog is something, that I work on. So too is dementia. So too is cognitive impairment or any kind of that. And stress plays a critical role in it. Migraine, neurological conditions, stress plays a role in everything. So it's critical to understand it, and to understand it in a way that we can do something about it in terms of maybe what we can do in terms of what we eat. I just want to backtrack a little bit. How can a mouse have no microbiome?
It's a great question. So we have a facility here in Cork called a germ-free facility. And basically, these are mice that are delivered. So I'll even back up for you. We get our microbes as a kind of a birthday present from our mother on the day we're born. And so as we emerge through the birth canal, the mum's microbes are passed on to the infant.
So it's at birth. So so the infant is completely sterile in neutral.
My neutral, for the most part, that's where the dogma is right now. There have been some reports, but it's very difficult because we're dealing with very low levels of mass, and it's hard to detect what is contamination versus what is real. So most people, I would say the vast majority of the community would say that we get our microbes on the day we're born as we emerge through the birth canal.
Okay.
And these bacteria play a key role in informing various aspects of immunology, especially in early life. And so it takes about 4 or 5 years before it starts to assemble completely and is influenced by a variety of factors. And we can come back to that later. What are these kind of factors in early life that can influence it? In our mouse models, we can actually keep a person completely sterile in a germ-free facility so they don't get exposed to any bacteria at all. They're delivered by cesarean section and then they're just completely sterile. And so that we can do. There's no real human translation, with maybe the exception being the boy in the bubble that Paul Simon sang about in the 1980s, you know.
And like, what about a baby that is delivered by cesarean?
So a baby that's been delivered by cesarean, and we've worked on this, is that they start to accumulate the microbes from the skin and from the hospital environment early on, and they have a very different...
Because they're not born into a sterile, but it's bacteria from the environment as opposed to from the mother,
you know. And so evolution has allowed that the mom's microbes change over pregnancy to be handed over as kind, you know, and so it's like a relay race. And and what happens in C-section is the baton gets dropped. So this is one of life's relay races. And we showed in a study that we just published this year that when we stratified Cork medical students based on their mode of delivery. So we took a group of those born by C-section and those born by normal vaginal delivery. And most people know which method they were. And then we brought them into the lab, and we had very good ethical ways of stressing people in the lab by making them do a public speech and some tricky mathematical tests that they're not aware of. And you can get a really good stress response. And those that were born by C-section, they actually had an elevated immune and psychological response to this acute stressor. Right. And that was kind of nice, but an acute stress is important. But I was also interested in, well, what about chronic stress? Because that's more interesting.
Their vulnerability to chronic stress. Yeah, so, because you could argue that a heightened acute stress response is actually adaptable.
Well, it could be. It could be.
You know, the chronic stress response can be maladaptive. I suppose the other can be, you know, if it's an inappropriate acute response, it's maladaptive.
And that's kind of what we wanted to get at. And so we then were thinking about how do we do this in an ethical fashion, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's what's good about being an educator, in that we subject our students to exams all the time. And so we can measure how the students respond over the examination period. And we found that those born by C-section had, again, an elevated immune and psychological response to this chronic stressful experience. And that was kind of cool, because, you know, it was the Cohen's perceived stress scale, and the effects were quite significant. Now, it's all relative, you know, like, you know, C-section is a life-saving surgical intervention.
And
you know, we don't want to be anyways blaming moms or anyone feeling guilty about it. It's important. And then in our animal studies, we've done more work where we've looked at this. And if we put microbes back into the animals that were born by C-section, we could actually recover the enduring effects, so they don't develop these long-term changes in their stress response or in brain and whatever else. So one of the things we're working on now is thinking of, you know, could we come up with solutions that could be offered to moms that have to have C-sections for whatever practical or medical reasons?
Yeah.
Could we develop strategies of getting bacteria back in there early on? And so there's a lot of activity in that.
So obviously there's a healthy microbiome and a not so healthy microbiome, which we can talk about a bit more. But I'm thinking about a mom. So you're talking comparing, you know, those born by C-section and those born naturally through the vaginal canal. But does it matter? And well, there's no way, I suppose, of testing that in hindsight, but assuming though, some mothers will have more healthy.
And so the studies, again, largely out of animal models, where they've looked at the impact of stress on the mums, so stress during pregnancy on the mums' bacteria, and showing that could pass on maybe not the best microbes. And so there may be times where a C-section might be the best option.
Yeah.
Like perhaps in gestational diabetes or other areas like that. So the jury's out, but it is interesting that, you know, something that can happen way back at birth can help program the systems in the body to be more sensitive later on.
Oh, absolutely. Overall. I mean, this is fascinating. I'll never get on to half the stuff I want to talk about. So we often hear that the gut is the second brain. So why is that? Like, why does it get that name as the second
brain? because you know, people don't realize is that we have a whole nervous system called the enteric nervous system within our gut. And this enteric nervous system, there's more neurons in it than there is in neurons of the nerve cells. So there's more nerve cells than there is in the spinal cord. And it's able to do a lot of things and not only keeps our digestive function happy, but it also communicates back with the vagus nerve and up to the brain. So, you know, and it's startling that, you know, what we're beginning to realize is that some of the symptoms of certain diseases, the first signs can happen in the gut. Like often Parkinson's disease, for example, some of the first signs of that come from the second brain in terms of constipation emerging up front. And now there's a growing literature showing that it may actually begin in the gut, and some of these misfolded proteins travel up to the brain from the gut. And so the gut is way more sophisticated than people have given it
credit for
at all. And then we're interested also in disorder. Is like irritable bowel syndrome. IBS, it's a very unloved disorder. You study other unloved disorders, Sabina, but this is another one, but very common and much more common in
women.
So
what's the difference? Because talk about that, because I think sometimes people, so there's irritable bowel syndrome and then there's irritable bowel disease, and they are two.
Inflammatory bowel disease.
They're two different things.
Very different.
I certainly would have had IBS, which is irritable bowel syndrome. But inflammatory bowel disease is a different thing, and it's a whole next level sort of.
Yeah, they're just different in terms of inflammatory bowel disease is an inflammation. It's Crohn's disease or colitis are the two major types. Irritable bowel syndrome, it's very difficult to find. It's a disease by exclusion, like many of these unloved diseases. Yeah. But it's definitely now appreciated to be a disorder of the gut-brain axis. So it's basically how our gut and our brain talk to each other. When that goes out of sync, people can get irritable bowel syndrome. And that's really, really important for people to realize that it's not all in their brain or all in their gut. It is actually how this communication goes. And that's why things like stress can cause flare-ups and people can get very sensitive and get very bloated or have real changes in their bowel patterns.
And it can be incredibly painful.
Pain.
Incredibly painful.
Really. And that's something we're also interested in studying, because, you know, people need to understand that this is there's a biological basis to this. And we've been interested in the microbiome in shaping this and understanding that the signals need to be kind of rewired back up between the gut and the brain to get that working.
I think it's fascinating. One other medical professional who I spoke to, who I'm fascinated by, she's Irish but based in London. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but Dr. Susan O'Sullivan. She's written
several books.
And we've chatted on this podcast as well about the hierarchy within medicine, about, you know, a biological source and a psychological source, you know, and how somehow a psychological source is lesser, or, you know, it's all in your head. And the patient goes away with, you're imagining things. But my argument is, you know, pain of any kind is all in your head. Symptoms of any kind are all in your head because they stem from the brain. And in order to experience pain, there has to be a cognitive aspect. You have to, you know, cognitively appreciate pain. And that's actually why things like, for some people, mindfulness. But I always say to people, you know, one way to deal with pain, whether it's chronic or I have migraine, one of the ways people say to me, how do you do all you do when you have chronic daily migraine? And I say, well, I love what I do, so I can lose myself in that. And they say, well, how do you do that? You know, how does that work? Well, it means my focus is on my work, not the pain. It doesn't mean that the pain, but I'm not cognitively paying attention to the pain. And that's the thing. You have pain signals, but you also have to have a cognitive perception of that pain to experience it. And in that is the power of the brain.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what we're finding is that the gut-brain axis can actually help regulate both the cognitive control, the top-down parts of it, but also the bottom-up signals that are driving the pain in the first place. So you know, I think the brain-gut axis is really powerful in our bodies and helps us really feel how we feel, and we have to keep it, look after it.
So the bottom-up part, so you said, right, so there's the brain part of it, and you know, that's maybe perceptions of stress, the psychological perception of stress, whether there is something to be stressed about or not, or whether it's a real stressor. So the bottom-up part of that is that our microbiome? Is that our diet? Is that our the psychobiotics come in?
Okay, so let's go back a little bit, because the microbiome, it's definitely our gut talking to our brain, and then our microbiome is really regulating what's going on in the gut. And the important thing to think about our microbiome is, I like to remind people, it's like a little factory. It produces all, and we get obsessed about the bacteria that are there, but it's actually not as much about the bacteria that are there, but what they're doing. And what they do is produce lots of chemicals that our bodies couldn't produce otherwise. You know, we were talking earlier about early life, and like one of the most fascinating things for me was when I found out that human breast milk, it has the most complex of sugars than any other form of milk made by mammals. About 20 times more complex than cow's milk. And these sugars are not even broken down. The infant has no capacity to break them down. And so you're like, why would evolution give us this really complex material and we can't break it down? But it's broken down by the bacteria. Okay. And what it's broken down to by the bacteria is key chemicals, including one called sialic acid, which is really important for brain development. So people are now studying infants in parts of Malawi and sub-Saharan Africa, where they've got stunted growth and stunted development, and shown that it's actually due to the lack of the bacteria in the gut to break down the sugars that come from the mum's breast milk. And so that allows for some aspects of that. And it's also taught why breastfed infants maybe a little bit more have higher IQ in a population-wide approach. So
I wasn't breastfed.
No, but no one was. Like, you know what I mean? Like my you know, no one.
And I didn't breastfeed my kids.
But that's not the, you know what I mean?
No, like, I know it's in a population level, and there's so many other factors come into play as you know. That's absolutely one of the tiny piece, and then it's interaction with kids interaction. And all the rest.
It's fascinating that evolution has given us these microbes, and what they're doing is breaking down. So if I go back to my factory analogy, so factories work due to two main things that are really important for factories. One is the quality of the workers, that's the microbes, and then the raw materials that come into the factory that the workers can work on. And the raw materials for your microbiome come from the diet. And so that's where the diet is really important. And so there are certain diets, like fibers in particular, and that are, we can't break them down, but the microbes can. So microbes, what they do is ferment fibers often to produce other chemicals, like one that we've done a lot of work on are called short chain fatty acids. They're a type of fatty acids that are really important. They're the energy for the gut cells that line our gut, these enterocytes. They use these short chain fatty acids as energy. And more recently, groups have shown, including our own group, that they're really important for not only the gut barrier function, which is really important in terms of maintaining normal immune function, but also the blood-brain barrier. That, you know, having these chemicals, if you change the levels of the chemicals, you can change how our blood-brain barrier works. And
the blood-brain barrier is really important, because the brain is very vulnerable to toxins. And this blood-brain barrier acts like a border that only lets very important and very particular sized, you know, molecules through, and it blocks anything that could be dangerous to your brain. So if the integrity of that blood-brain barrier is damaged in any way, your brain is at risk. It's very important that it's kept healthy.
And it's really the fortress aspect. And so the discovery that that chemicals broken down by microbes from what you eat could influence that, then just really, and we know this also all the way into old age, and especially in Alzheimer's disease and aging, we see that things start to go wrong, the fortress starts to crumble, and we need to look at ways to keep it. But diet is the real key factor in all aspects of gut-brain signaling, because it regulates what these microbes are doing.
And I'm going to go, before we go, I do want to talk about, you know, a healthy gut diet, but I'm also interested in, I'm sure our listeners are. So you say, I mean, as I recall from reading the book, you know, not actually, let's backtrack as well. We keep seeming to backtrack. I love in the book how you kind of describe and you explain how we have this. It's a sort of a symbiosis. And you talk about us humans as a sort of a hybrid. Could you kind of explain that a little bit?
Yeah.
It's kind of creepy. I know when I read it, it kind of made me feel a bit creepy, but it's kind of fascinating too.
Well, it all goes back. I always like to put things in an evolutionary context.
Yes, I do too. That's the way I feel about human behavior or anything that happens. You just said it about the milk. My feeling is, I don't believe there's anything such as a bad behavior. You know, often people label things as a bad behavior or, you know, a good behavior. For me, behaviors evolved because they serve some sort of purpose.
Maybe
using it in the wrong time and therefore it mightn't have the right result. But something like anger has evolved because it serves a purpose. If you use it at the wrong point in time against the wrong person or in the wrong way, maybe that's wrong. But anger itself isn't bad.
It
serves a purpose.
No, I totally agree. But on an evolutionary perspective, it's really worth reminding ourselves that we are actually living in a microbial world. Microbes were here long before humans. And so, you know, the powerhouses of our cells, the organelle in our cells that you know, gives us all energy, is called the mitochondria. Well, the mitochondria is just a microbe that got lost. It was actually a bacteria that got lost into the cell. And so we've evolved. And
like, it's the powerhouse. It's the generator.
Yeah. It's a microbe originally.
Wow.
You know, so a single cell organelle. But anyway, and so there's never been a time where the brain has existed across evolution without microbial signals. And so that's one of the things that we've been really interested in, is trying to understand the basis of this, and that we are a combination of both our genes from our human genes, but also our microbial genes. And if you looked at it, we are more than 99% microbial in terms of genes.
Yeah,
all of the money that medicine has spent on the Human Genome Project is for 1% of our genes. We have more microbial cells than we do human cells. And
there's a call for more investment into research on microbial genes.
Well, it's really important. And so in a study, a paper some years ago, together with a zoologist colleague here, John Quinn, and an evolutionary microbiologist in the US, because one of the things that we found, going back to these germ-free mice, one of the things we kept finding was the social brain was very sensitive to these disturbances in the microbiome. So that was really remarkable to me, was that if you grow up without microbes and you're a mouse, you don't have normal social interactions. So when we started looking across the animal kingdom, whether it was bumblebees in a hive or baboons in the wild, there's a growing evidence that if you start to change social structures, that you change the microbiome. And that if you change the microbiome by whatever means, by diet or other you change social structures. So just think, over the last 3 years of lockdowns where we've changed the microbiome by being very hygienic and really changed, you know, how we respond to things. And we changed social structure by, you know, lockdowns. What have we done to this gut-brain signaling?
But also what's fascinating in that regard as well is if you go back to, and I won't try and say her name, the Brazilian neuroscientist who actually counted how many neurons we have in the brain by making brain soup, Susanna. Yeah. Anyway, she is a Brazilian name, but her whole argument is that, you know, fire, cooking food is what accelerated human evolution because it allowed us time to be more social, you know, and the time that, you know, an ape, you know, has to spend munching food 10 hours a day. Fire freed up and released energy that we could consume in minutes that we say had saved all these hours having to masticate, chew food. We now could spend time talking to each other, learning language, showing each other how to do things. So the social brain developed, our neocortex developed, and all because of food. And then obviously our gut biome changed because we're eating cooked food.
Absolutely.
That's fascinating.
And it's all connected. And that's the thing, you know, Sabina, it's all connected. And so it's really understanding that piece is really important for framing. Because people say to me, God, John, if you're really interested in neurobiology of emotions, why are you so fixated on the gut?
I think that's fascinating.
But it is really, you know, that it's not just phrases like, you know, the gut feelings and the gutsy moves and the gutters for disappointment, but actually there is an underlying biology to this.
Oh no, of course there is. And I talk about the gut feeling because a lot of people trust their gut feeling over, you know, but sometimes that gut feeling isn't accurate. You know, sometimes your gut feeling is actually unconscious messages that you're not reading consciously. But sometimes it's also, you know, it's an error. Do you know what I mean? And your rational brain needs to kick in. It's just we need to kind of play around with it. Just going back to what you said there in terms of the social brain and the microbiome, it's kind of fascinating. So you're also interested in neurodevelopmental disorders. I'm kind of jumping around a bit. And then we also spoke about the bacteria and in, you know, that happening in the birth canal. And, you know, say in terms of something like autism and not understanding fully, you know, the etiology of autism, but I know certainly, the little bit that I know of it, you know, that it's, you know, there's partly some of it is something that happens in utero. You know, have you done anything? Is there any relationship around that? Given the social, you know, that social, social issue.
For sure. And when we started, you know, discovering this social brain deficit in these experiments, you know, it did bring us into the world of autism, which is very complex. I mean, I should start off by saying that autism is predominantly or has a very strong genetic basis. Yeah. But that all I'm saying in that is that there are genes involved and there, you know, there's a lot of work now trying to understand what these genes are. But not everyone who has the genes have the same manifestation because autism is very heterogeneous and the incidence has increased dramatically in terms of detection and everything. So the question
is, I think a lot of people don't understand necessarily. I mean, there still persists a misconception that if something is genetic, it's fixed.
Yeah.
But genes switch on and off and environment switches genes on and off and you know, factors and, you know, like upbringing and you know, so many factors can switch genes on and off. So genetic doesn't mean, you know, definitely inherited.
Absolutely. You
know, it's not fixed in stone.
No, not at all. But there is also a strong link. So there's accumulating data out there showing that in especially children with autism, that they have a different microbiome. I think that's more or less but the question is, it's the chicken and egg question, is what's driving what? Children with autism are also picky eaters.
That's what eating white food and refusing to eat certain things. Yeah.
So that makes it difficult to disentangle overall. There's been some recent meta-analysis type approaches where people are looking at large scale studies and complex biostatistics to really disentangle what's causative and what's correlational and all of that. And it seems to be something quite, you know, quite remarkable. In our lab, we've been doing some animal studies where we're showing that, you know, single strains of bacteria can have beneficial effects on some of the core symptoms of autism. So they can promote sociability, they can reduce repetitive behavior, and they can make communication better. So I'm very, you know, excited about some of the potential that we have in doing that. But I'm also aware that, you know, we do live in a very world where we need to accept neurodiversity and really be aware of that, and that we're not trying to fix things. We just want to make people have adjunctive treatments that may make their quality of life better overall. And I think, you know, but it goes back to the social brain is also relevant to other disorders like social anxiety disorder. These are people who probably benefited from lockdowns and COVID, where there was no expectation to leave the house. Overall, we've been studying their microbiome, finding it's quite different, and we're also, you know, showing that that can be causally relevant to some of the social behavior. And then the social deficits in other neurodevelopmental, like schizophrenia, has a social component. There's also social elements. You brought it up already about how we eat and the, you know, the interactions between the hormones that are involved in instigating eating and eating behavior, and the rewarding aspects of eating could also be put in a social context. We all prefer.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, eating. Yeah, I've done research on that, you know, where we looked at, you know, eating in later life, and actually malnourishment. And yeah, you know, the social aspect of it is absolutely critical, because it's a lot of older people, you know, who've been widowed, and their social circle is limiting, and then they don't bother eating. Yeah. But also that, you know, but it's the social aspect encourages us to eat more.
Absolutely. So that's what we would hope to develop, some form of solutions through our microbiome that would enhance sociability across many different, you know, types of disorders or types of behaviors, and try and provoke people to be more social. Yeah,
there's two things I want to kind of pick up on that interests me. The whole neurodiversity thing, I think, you know, everything works. I think because medicine has so long been, you know, sort of tick box, you know, you're depressed, or you're anxious, or you're, rather than all of these things run on a continuum. Yeah. And so does our neurological capacity, and, you know, we experience, we're diverse across many aspects of our cognitive capacities. And I'm totally with this sort of, you know, the movement of, you know, accepting neurodiversity and the positivities associated with that. I do a lot of corporate wellness talks, and thankfully a lot of employers are asking me to talk about the benefits of having neurodiverse members on the team, and how it can, you know, brainstorming can, you know, produce, you know, more creative responses, etc. But also then I do have a, you just mentioned it there, you were being cautious about saying, you know, oh, there's possible, you know, there's potential in looking at the microbiome in terms of, you know, encouraging, you know, and you sort of preempted and said, I'm not talking about having to fix someone, you know, because there's a lot in this movement that says we don't want to be fixed. However, sort of having so my own son would have dyslexia and would have had certain issues around, would have terrible trouble as a child. And I suppose some of it persists in distinguishing facial expressions. Mm. And also as a consequence, and I think a lot of kids with any of those kind of learning challenges, they naturally are anxious because the world is very hard for them to understand, because they can't read those social signals. They can't read a lot of them, and it's very challenging. And I mean, he studied biochemistry and immunology, and then he went on and studied medicine, and very proud of him doing all that with all those challenges. But I know for sure he would have taken a fix rather than having to do all those things, you know, with all those challenges. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, I think there's plenty out there who would rather, you know, have have less of the diversity and more of that. I'd rather a little bit more, you know, seeing things as other people.
Sure.
I think he can do both. I think he can offer solutions for those who would like
to experience it in a different way. But all that is just diversity of approaches in itself.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
So I think that's where we need to be. We need to be aware. I mean, the going back to one of your initial points, I mean, the main thing to say is that things are not fixed and that the brain is plastic and the brain is amenable to signals from the gut that could actually help to rewire some of these core circuits that are underpinning these social responses. And I think that's what I'm saying. And one of the key things in neuroscience now is about understanding these circuits and trying to understand, well, okay, signal comes in from the gut, it goes in here into the brainstem, then it goes into regions that we know like the amygdala, which is involved in fear and social behavior. And then if we can try and disentangle these, then we can actually kind of hopefully rewire them in different ways.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So tell me how the gut can influence whether we feel depressed.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and like many things, we still don't know a full answer, but we do know that the microbiome is different in people who are depressed. We also should say that we do know that the drugs that we use to treat depression also changes the microbiome, and maybe some of the side effects may be due to that as well. But in depression, probably one of the best studies was a large scale study out of Belgium some years ago, where they showed that there was a lack of specific bacteria that produced key chemicals involved in tryptophan metabolism and in production of these short chain fatty acids. So that was like over 1,000 people, and they looked at it and they were able to pin that down. More recently, studies have shown from Australia and from London, and we also did, it was one of our lockdown projects where you just look at the entire literature that's out there and see, can you come up with something that would say in all of these depression studies, are there any trends? And again, it seems that there seems to be a lack of bacteria that produce short chain fatty acids in particular. And so we've shown that even when we take these microbes from humans and we put them into animals, we could actually, the animals started to develop some of the core symptoms of depression. They didn't have pleasure in normal things that they would, and they developed a kind of an inflammatory phenotype. So it's helping us think that this might be something causal there. Then in tandem, what colleagues in Australia have shown, that a diet that's very good for your microbiome, this is a Mediterranean style diet, which is good for many things. This was called the SMILES trial. And they showed that this trial, when they gave it to people on top of their antidepressants and on top of their psychotherapy, so it wasn't,
on its own.
On its own, but that the people got very well.
Okay.
And so they didn't
better have... than if they were just taking their psychotherapy
and
their medication.
Yeah. Exactly.
And so is that, and so the particular, microbiome that you said was lacking,
that would be known to come from a Mediterranean diet?
Well, so, we would hope so. All of these dots haven't been joined up, and you know.
Right. Okay, but so, that's what so you would then hope to. That would be the hypothesis. Yeah, I mean, the good old Mediterranean diet. It just comes everywhere. I mean, you know, it's the best for brain health. It's the best for dealing with.
But I think if we called it the brain health diet, it would people find Mediterranean is exotic. And,
I mean, to me, it's if you think back, probably it's the diet that allowed our brain to expand and evolve into the wonderful brain that it became, because it's raw fruit and vegetables and food as close to its natural sources as possibly can be, and oily fish. Fish that you can, and then olive oil. That's it. And it actually is the simplest diet to eat and to cook with. I know now myself, I kind of have struggled since I got COVID this last time but one, and I'm gone full on back now on the Mediterranean diet again. You know, I mean, we all slip on and off. You and I know all the things we should be doing, but we're human first. That's what I always say to me. Hey, I'm a human being first. And actually that brings me nicely to something like that. So cravings, what happens when we crave stuff? What has the microbiome got to do
with that? Well, you know, it's again, some of the studies have come from animals, sort of, even studies in fruit flies have shown that if you change the microbiome of fruit flies, they crave completely different foods. So they usually like a protein rich diet. And then when the microbiome was changed, they no longer had this preference for protein. And so again, the data is only emerging, but you know, maybe some of the reward pathways in the brain are also sensitive to the microbiome. Like, you know, we showed that we could attenuate how animals respond to cocaine based on their microbiome levels in their gut. So again, you know, that's a really extreme circumstance. But what food cravings are is basically the wanting aspects, you know, of our brain looking for rewarding processes. And so we would there's a lot of accumulating data to say that the dopamine pathways in the brain that are underpinning that and the cognitive control of that, which is the impulsive aspects, are also sensitive to microbial signals.
So then that brings me kind of around. So obviously, you know, the dopamine pathway, the reward pathways, the pleasure pathway, they're all linked to motivation to engage in an activity again. Yeah. And when you're talking about something that involves alcohol or other drugs, you can then ultimately end up with an addiction or, you know, substance use, misuse disorder or use disorder or whatever. So then if you take that down to a teenage brain where the frontal lobes are not yet formed, so there's minimal capacity for overriding those, you know, more immediate urges. On top of that, the teenage brain, the emotional brain in a teenage brain, the dopamine, the reward pathways in a teenage brain are heightened. They're actually primed to seek novelty and reward and pleasure, which makes sense because, you know, they're training to be adults. So they need as much novelty and experience so that they can learn about the world, which is why I say they need parents to be their frontal lobes rather than to be just let run away with it. They actually need adults to be their frontal lobes, but it makes them particularly vulnerable to alcohol and other substances. No. So could their diet help in some way?
It's a great question. We've just done a study on alcohol binge drinking in a young population and looked at the microbiome, and it was quite different. And we were able to link it to some inhibitory control mechanisms that seem to be gone wrong overall. And so I was encouraging.
Was that in adults or in teens?
It was post-teen, but we would. So
young adults still.
Young adults.
Under 25, so still.
Under 25. So still
developing frontal lobes.
Absolutely. And so for ethical reasons, we wanted to focus on over 18s in this study. But they were young. And we're very interested in this extended adolescent period anyway, because
technically it's adolescence up till 25 from a pure developmental point of view. Although try and tell a 24-year-old they're an adolescent.
But we did find that there seemed to be a link towards, when we did some behavioral tasks linked to inhibition, that we could correlate the changes in the microbiome with that. And so I suggested, you know, we at the time I remember suggesting to the researcher in my team, and she's now moved to Belgium, and she's a really talented psychologist. And I said, well, could we come up with a what would I call a prebiotic or a diet that you could, you know, probably prevent some of the damaging effects of alcohol on the microbiome that would then feed onto the inhibition. And so, you know, and it's something now that she's exploring because it could. Now, it's difficult. It's difficult because the messaging would need to be interesting, because you can't say, you know, take this diet and go out and binge drink. But if they're going to go and binge drink anyway, maybe it may have a less effect.
It's interesting, but
again, everything is connected, Sabina, and I guess that's where we're going.
That's where we're at.
And people have also studied the social aspects of drinking and the microbiome and driving the social behavior as well. So that's all connected back to where we started.
It's fascinating.
From.
And then immune related disorders is something that kind of it interests me, you know, because so many autoimmune disorders have brain fog as a symptom, you know, the impact on cognitive functioning, possibly. And I think this is related to long COVID also, possibly, because then, you know, there's related to inflammation, and the inflammation may impact on the brain cell communication, either through damage or just, you know, cell death even, but are just interfering with the communication.
Absolutely. We used to think the brain was immune privileged, but we now know that the immune system is really important regulator of brain function. And what regulates our immune system? It's our microbiome. Microbiome, is especially in the gut microbiome, is one of the greatest regulators we have of our immune system, and therefore is implicated in everything that the immune system plays a role in. And where the collateral effects can be when the immune system is under attack and it starts to mount a response, it can have these collateral effects on brain function that can lead to cognitive changes and neuroinflammation. And depending on where that happens across the lifespan, whether it's in early life or in aging, it can have really pernicious effects.
And can the microbiome help protect against, or can it play a role in when the immune response goes out of whack and becomes an autoimmune response?
In a lot of studies working on autoimmunity, in both in the context of inflammatory bowel diseases, multiple sclerosis, and various arthritic conditions, you know,
rheumatoid
overall
arthritis.
So what we've been more interested in is looking at so for example in middle age is a time window that I'm quite interested in, as you can imagine. And in the middle age brain, there's already inflammation starting to happen in the brain. So neuroinflammation is already occurring. And we showed a couple of years ago in an animal study that when we treated the animals with a what we call a prebiotic, so it's in this case, it was inulin. Now, inulin is found in many vegetables like leeks and chicory and artichokes, but we fed it in pure form to animals, and we were able to completely slow down the inflammation in the brain overall. So, like, you know, it was a really great result, because it meant that, okay, the microbiome, you can target the microbiome to slow down inflammation in the brain. And it means that for your listeners, if they're thinking of having a midlife crisis, maybe they should forget about the motorbikes and turn to the leeks instead.
I'm interested. So tell me, and we're running out of time. So
yeah, sure.
Tell me, prebiotics, probiotics, psychobiotics.
Yeah.
Because I'm interested also, just even personally myself, you know, in reducing inflammation in my body, and also histamine. For me, I have an overactive histamine response. Do you know what I mean? I'm in I constantly get what you call that
allergy.
Not even just allergy, but particularly actually COVID again, this mad itch all the time. Would have other, you know, rhinitis and, you know, all things that are, you know, overactive histamine. So taking antihistamines, but antihistamines impact on your cognitive functioning or can, you know, they operate on your CNS. So again, sure. I'm interested in a diet that can help balance out, you know, help control inflammation and
So I've asked you
two questions there, sort of pre-pro and psychobiotics, and then
Probiotics are live microorganisms taken in adequate amounts that confer a health benefit. So the last part is the bit of the is the sting in the tail, because that confer a health benefit. To prove that something confers a health benefit, you have to have done clinical trials or human trials of some sort. And a lot of what's called probiotics on the market have never been through any form of trials whatsoever.
Right.
So but the probiotics are single strains of live bacteria. Prebiotics are basically dietary substances that are really important in promoting the beneficial endogenous bacteria that we have overall.
So it's just, it's food.
Food. But you can get it and it's real, you can buy it as a raw material because, you know.
It hasn't been processed yet.
But exactly. So you can.
Go and buy a leek.
Fiber, really good overall. Vegetables are really good for this, you know, in relation to it. And so the diet, we just have a study coming out, which is really exciting for me, because it's basically, we took a group of, because I wanted to test my hypothesis. So everything that I was doing was leading up to that. We should be able to get a diet, and I call it a psychobiotic diet. So it's a diet that's good for your mental health through your bacteria. So really ramping up fiber intake in the diet, really ramping up fermented foods in the diet. Okay. These are your yogurts, your kefirs, your kombuchas, your kimchi, miso, like sauerkraut, all of these things that are really
good. And
will
you tell me also what you would list as fiber, healthy fiber?
Would it be from
vegetables or?
A lot of it is from vegetables, but also certain grains as well. You know,
but would you go for the grains before they're processed, and or would you say buy whole grain bread? Or do you know what I mean? Because I think there's a lot of confusion out there in terms of getting fiber in your diet.
Well, there's different types of fibers and resistant and non-resistant starches and ones that have different functions overall. But and there's also a lot of people who can't tolerate fiber.
Yeah.
Like if you have inflammatory, you know, bowel disease, you know, so it's about getting the sweet spot of tolerability overall. And so people who are on, let's say, certain diets for IBS, they don't tolerate fibers very well, some of them. So like, you know, it's really about, but for this study, we just said ramp up your fiber, you know, as much to what you can find comfortable and what you can tolerate. And we did it for 1 month. So we took people who were stress sensitive and had low fiber in their diet already. Our student population was a great resource for that.
Yeah.
And in 1 month.
Hot noodles don't tend to be a healthy diet.
No. But in 1 month, it's been 4 weeks, we were able, it's a study of 45 people, we were able to completely change their stress response.
Wow.
And their sleep quality improved, their depression scores were better. Across the board, their overall health and well-being. Now, the ironic thing is when we looked at the microbiome, it didn't change that much. So what we did was we actually fed the microbiome rather than change it. So by just feeding it with the fibers and the fermented foods and everything else that we were giving it, it was able to have this really important effect.
And, the fermented foods is what's more new to me, because we all have heard about the high fiber and the Mediterranean diet, but a Mediterranean diet by definition wouldn't really have fermented foods.
Well, it depends what parts of the, it depends if you're in parts of Greece or, you know, places that would have a culture. We just don't have a culture in Ireland really of fermented foods. And really fermented foods are you know, people often think they're for middle class people going to expensive food stores. No, like the great thing about fermented foods is that you can make them yourself at home, and they cost very little. Like I take kefir, which is milk kefir, which is cost all it costs is the milk that you use in it, and it's a great fermented food. I can tell when I haven't taken it. It's really good. You know, you feel good taking it every day, and it's just basically a clump of bacteria, and it grows. You basically put your milk into it, and it ferments the milk, and overnight, and you have it the next day, and it's great.
Okay, and it tastes good.
It's a bit sour, so I tend to have it with
would
other
yogurt. Would you put fruit in it or something?
Could people do? People put fruits. Some people put. I put yogurt in. I like putting flavored yogurt just to take away the thingy, to flavor it. If you like, you know, if you like that kind of sour taste, and you know, if you like that, some people like it. I don't particularly.
Yeah, I can't imagine I would.
So, but I leave it in the fridge overnight and then I have it in that way. So
it's fascinating because I have to say, you know, like I always feel if ever I have to say, you know, as I've got older, you know, in terms of managing mental health and things like IBS and all those, I'm much, much better at managing my stress levels. And I do think that's one of the benefits of getting older. You know, you do become wiser. And I think what people need to kind of understand is that becoming yourself is a process. Do you know what I mean? Like when you're young, you're just learning, and you, as you get older, you do learn how to manage stress and things, and you learn what things put you off. Yeah, sorry, go on.
But maybe becoming yourself is also realizing that you have to also become your microbial self.
No, exactly. You know what foods you can eat and what you can't. For example, I love porridge. I think porridge is really healthy. My husband starts the day with porridge. I love it. I love the taste of it, but I cannot eat it. My stomach just absolutely bloats and hurts me. Do you know what I mean? But I know other foods, and I know there's other foods that I eat will, you know, upset me. But I also know that when I experience feeling down, anxiety, you know, those unpleasant, you know, what we call less than mental health. I'm not talking because I think we talk about, when we talk about mental health, we're really talking about the avoidance of depression and anxiety. We're not talking into that psychiatric disorders. I'd love to get into the place where we're talking about when people are empowered and knowledgeable to have their most optimal mental health. Well, you know? But well, I always feel those things in my gut. That's where I feel them. I get a funny feeling in my gut.
And we talked earlier, Sabina, about genes and genetics. And with your genes, you know, there isn't an awful lot you can do except blame your parents and your grandparents. Whereas with your microbes, there you have potential to change them and modify them.
Yeah.
And that gives people agency. It gives people agency over their own health.
I think that's what's important. You know, my father had, you know, bipolar disorder. My mother had issues also. But that gives you power in a sense, because it has always made me super aware that I have to manage those things. And if I feel a niggling in my tummy, I go, okay, what's going on in my life? What do I need to address before it takes shape? It also meant that when I noticed as a child that my son was anxious, well, we need to figure out how to give him tools.
Yeah.
Something that, say, my father never had. And that, do you know? So I think those things, knowing that there's some sort of genetic tendency, can also be very empowering, because there are so many other things that you can do. And a genetic tendency is only a tiny piece of the puzzle, because environment and lifestyle play such a big factor. I'm going to have to let you go because you've been so kind with your time. Before we end, I like to end every episode with asking my guests for their favorite tip for surviving and thriving and or thriving in life.
Well, so if it's to do with my science, I would say, you know, really try and increase the levels of fiber and fermented foods in your diet. But my main
if it's to do it yourself, well,
you know, don't like as a stress neurobiologist, the thing that I see people most stressed about is being perfectionistic and trying to do too much too well. And people often ask me, how do I do everything? You know, I'm now vice president for research and innovation in the university, and I have a large research group of over 40 people, and you know, I have a family life with wonderful kids and my wife, you know. So it's managing all of that is perhaps not being too perfectionistic. It's one of the advices I give to my younger colleagues is you know just keep trying as much as you can, and be resilient and not afraid of failure. Not afraid to you know, that's the other part of that I find is people are afraid and don't celebrate failing.
Yeah. John, it has been absolutely fascinating talk to you. I'm sure I'll have you on again if you ever have the time in the future.
I hope that you found this episode as fascinating and indeed as useful as I did. Since recording the episode, I've been upping my roughage intake by eating more fruit and veg. And I've also added fermented foods to my diet. Now, I'll be honest, and I'll say that some of them just don't appeal to me, but I've had a little try here and there. And I found kefir. I found those yogurts actually very, very palatable, very nice, to be honest. And yogurts anyway, I mean, I actually wouldn't be a huge fan, but these I found very palatable. And I can take some of the kombuchas. It depends on the flavor. I take them in smaller doses. I would tend towards a Mediterranean diet anyway, because it's the best sort of diet for brain health. But I'm human, and, you know, every now and then the processed foods slip back in, you get a bit lazy, the white processed foods come in, you're tired, and you'll throw on a pot of pasta that takes like 2 minutes to cook, and you'll slop some butter on it and some chilies on top, and, you know, there you go, you have a satisfying meal, and there's no fruit veg on it, and it's white flour, and you know, it's easy to fall back into that. But after talking to John, I kind of decided I'm kind of pushing those out again. And actually, that combined with the upping the roughage intake with the fruit and veg and the fermented foods, I have to say, I have noticed that my head feels a lot clearer. I think I'm sleeping a little bit better. And let's just say that my bowels have been performing in a very healthy way. My name is Sabina Brennan, and you have been listening to Super Brain, the podcast for everyone with a brain.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.